Record. All right, we're recording. So welcome to Smart People Dumb Brains.
Yes, we remember the name of it.
Yes.
Episode two,
yes. I'm Brenda Martinez. I'm a therapist here in San Antonio.
And I'm Paige Harper. I'm also, oddly enough, a therapist here in San Antonio.
Yeah. And so I think last time that we did our podcast, we talked about talking about self-compassion. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're gonna kind of stick today. Where do you want to start, Faith? You talked a little bit about Kristen Neff before.
Yeah.
Time.
So there's been a lot of people who have written about self-compassion. Sort of the leading researchers in the area I consider to be Kristen Neff and Christopher Grimmer. And she wrote, the book is called, oddly enough, Self-Compassion. And I think it's been out about 10 years now. And she's up at UT Austin. Mm-hmm. And she, it's a fantastic book. She talks about her own process of going through her divorce and doing dumb shit, because she's a human and we do dumb shit. And how she had to process that and, you know, and heal and come back around and deal with herself. And she started mindfulness meditation, and that's where she bumped into self-compassion, is through that practice. And I love the book, because academics don't tend to write honestly about their dumb shit. And I love that she did. And she talked about this process and this, you know, and the issue and the work that she had to do. And so she's been researching it now for about a decade. She works with Chris Germer pretty frequently. She's probably a little more academic, and he's probably a little bit more Buddhist-y. If you're like, which book should I buy? They're both really good, and they complement each other. But so she was very interested, being a research psychologist, like, what actually is self-compassion? What are the components of it? How do people work with it? How do I measure it? And so that's been her research. And some of this stuff that was really interesting, you know, there's this idea of, like, self-compassion is just letting myself be a dick. It's, you know, letting myself off the hook. And the opposite is true. You know, now that we have a lot of research, most of it being hers, we found that, so the idea of, people talk all the time about self-esteem and,
kind of moves away from the idea of self-esteem.
Right, because she said that's external, right? So right. If you get an A on a test, that's really good for your self-esteem. And if you studied really hard and you bomb it, it's really bad for your self-esteem. And self-compassion is about your you know, you deserve to be alive in the world and take up space, and you deserve kindness and consideration. And so it's not a letting yourself off the hook. It's you know, recognizing yourself as a human being who has value no matter what. And her research shows when we do that, we're far more likely to change and do good things than if we get caught up in this ebb and flow of self-esteem.
Yeah.
Our self-esteem takes a nosedive, and we're like, well, screw it then, it doesn't matter. And then we continue to do dumb stuff. And if we're self-compassionate, we actually hold ourselves to a higher standard, because we're like, yeah, this is really hard, and this is why, and we are able to work through it. And so we're far more likely to meet our goals and be better people if we're self-compassionate. Like, there's this idea, like, well, that's just letting myself off the hook. I have to beat myself up. And beating oneself up doesn't work. As we know, as therapists, you know, I always tell people, like, and so, like, the beating yourself up has worked super well for you for the past 4 decades. Are you desperate enough to try it my way?
Right.
Yeah.
I think that when I looked up Kristen Neff, I think it was all great. I found Paul Gilbert, which is the developer of the compassionate focused therapy.
Yes.
Who kind of really, I think for me, Kristen was the researcher who was doing all the research, who was getting all the information to be able to build on the compassion focused therapy, which Paul, for me, spoke my language. Mm-hmm. Much more, I think, structured, because it's not really, it's similar to CBT, but it's not CBT. Mm-hmm. It uses some psychodynamic stuff. And so for me, it delved a little bit deeper into how do we build the capacity for self-compassion. Mm-hmm. I think is really hard for people is you know, when we talk to our clients, we're okay, well, how can you be compassionate with yourself? And they're like, I don't fucking know. Like, if I could have done it, I would have been doing it. I wouldn't need you to tell me that. So for me, it helped me to kind of really conceptualize, like, how can I help my clients really begin to build the capacity and build the skill base to be able to engage in self-compassion? Because I know, Kristen, I think one of the things that she talks about is to treat yourself like a friend, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of one of the things that I know that that stuck with me with some of her stuff, was that you know, you wouldn't be critical to a friend and yet you're doing it to yourself. So how do we begin to shift some of that language into a more compassionate language? And with Paul Gilbert, I think that I found Yvette Aramis, which talks about compassionate communication. Mm-hmm. So there's like this much deeper delve into like, how do we even get there?
Yeah.
Because it's very challenging when we have an internal critic that has been there for 4 years, right? And so how do we beat that guy into being self-compassionate? And so I found it really interesting that there's like therapies on how to kind of like figure out how to do this and to help our clients.
And there's a book called The Compassionate Mind, which is literally about how it changes the brain. There's so much out there now. There's definitely, if somebody's interested in it, you don't have to be Team Kristen Neff. Like you said, there's a way into it that's going to match how you see the world. And actually, one of the issues that I've bumped into was exactly that of teaching people how to do it. And she has this three-step process and this factor analysis, but I saw people getting stuck, and so I've adapted it some because I always feel embarrassed when I say that, like, oh well, I changed Kristen Neff's model because I'm a fangirl, so that's like super embarrassing. But I found that people getting stuck in that process, and that's the hard part of it, is doing this. And I've been doing this work for a decade now. I discovered her book pretty early on, and I'm like, this is something that I need for myself, and this is useful and valid and complex work, and it's still a struggle, and it's like, I'm not being compassionate, and then there's like, yeah, you can't even be self-compassionate, you dumb bitch, like, you know, so it becomes this cycle. And I had a client, I remember when he first called me to enter therapy, he's like, I need therapy because I'm a piece of shit. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, people that are pieces of shit usually aren't like actively seeking therapy, so you're probably not. He's like, no, you're a total piece of shit, like, you don't even know me, I'm horrible. He wasn't but when doing the self-compassion work, he actually read Kristen's book, and he's like, okay, got it, you know. So I'm a couple weeks later, okay, so doing the self-compassion thing, rocking and rolling, but I'm still a piece of shit. I'm like, yeah, you're not doing the self-compassion thing, let's step that back. And once he was actually able to really apply that and catch himself when he wasn't doing it, and go in it and do that work with that level of mindfulness, is when he graduated from therapy. Like, that, once he had that, you know, that practice down, and, you know, had good skills, that was the big thing that he needed. And kind of like, you're going to be ready to graduate when you can agree with me that you're not a piece of shit. And yeah. And that was huge for him. So I found, because I had written a zine on some of her research and Chris Vermeer's research, because I was asked to write about self-esteem, and that sent me on one of my ranty things. Yeah. And my publisher was like, okay, so what do you want to write about? And so her three-part is the mindfulness, the self-kindness, like you mentioned, and then the common humanity. And I saw people get stuck in the mindfulness. Of like, when you start paying attention to all that, especially if you're doing it really for the first time, that feels really overwhelming, and you don't know what to attend to. And so one thing that I found that's been helpful for people is I brought in, so Marshall Rosenberg wrote the Nonviolent Communication Materials, NBC. And he passed some time ago, but his foundation still exists. A lot of his materials can be found online. And he used to work with world leaders and all this stuff. And he had this idea called self-empathy. And when I added that to Kristen's stuff on mindfulness, I saw that be very helpful for people. So if y'all have my self-compassion Z, you already know it, it's already in there. So if we're tuning into all of that internal experience and that's super overwhelming, he's like, but what's like the core need that's not being met? What is the core issue there? And the self-empathy is when we kind of like, okay, so what is it that is really pushing my buttons right now? And that kind of helps deal with the mindfulness clutter. And I have found that tool to be really helpful because mindfulness, like self-compassion, is really difficult if you've never done it. I mean, it's really difficult even if you've done it for decades.
Right. I think that there's a challenge with people. I mean, you say mindfulness. I think in my mind, it's about awareness. Mm-hmm. And so when people can become aware of, I'm meeting my need of feeling loved by doing drugs, right? Whatever. Sometimes they still don't know what to do with that. And so that's, I think, where they get stuck is like, okay, like I'm aware now that I'm doing drugs because I want to feel loved for whatever reason. But what do I do about it?
What do I do with that? Yeah.
Now, what do I do with that? And so I think that like with my clients, I will talk a little bit about, because I talk a lot about recovery with all of my clients, right? So we're always talking about like taking baby steps into recovery and kind of the awareness is to help you be aware of it. And then you get to make a very conscious decision about how do you want to move forward? Do you want to move forward with that critical, that inner critic of, oh, you're so stupid. Like, why can't you just stop? You're not normal. Or do we talk about like, now you have this awareness that you're doing this thing that's unhealthy for you because you want to feel loved and you get to make a very conscious decision about how you want to proceed. And so then we have that conversation about how do you want to proceed? You know, do you want to continue to do that? And the answer is always no, because people are in therapy at my end because they're in recovery. But because they want something different for themselves and they want a sense of peace. And so they'll come up with ideas of what they can do to begin to feel compassionate for themselves. One of the challenge for people who are beginning this work, I think, is that they feel very much like it's fake. It's not me. Mm-hmm. That's, again, I think one of those things in terms of are their needs getting met, but it's not even really who I am. And I get told, like, I don't really want to change who I am because that's not me. It feels fake. It's not authentic. And so then we have to delve into that. Like, what is the value system that's really connected to that? And really kind of address that, right? So this stuff can actually put us in a position where we're doing a lot of work. Like with your client, you know, it's long-term work sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because we're looking at and delving into like value systems, that inner critic, and really kind of getting them to be mindful of all those things and to be able to be conscious about the decisions that they're making versus it just being kind of like an emotional memory, muscle memory, like it's just automatic.
This is like uncomfortable.
Right.
I engage, yeah.
Is now we get to make a choice. We're aware, we get to make a choice.
That's the majority of the battle is the awareness. I tell clients, it's like when you look at something under a microscope, you have to put it on the slide and you have to turn on the light so you can see it. And the minute you do that, it reacts to the light. Yes. So the minute you start paying attention to your shit, you're going to start reacting to it differently just by noticing it. And it gets harder to get back on your bullshit if you're noticing what's going on. And people were like, okay, yeah, mindfulness. But real mindfulness of it is going to start shifting the patterns immediately.
Absolutely. I always tell my clients, like, you come into my office and it's like, I open Pandora's box and I'm like, what is all of this, right? Because we're having this awareness and I'm making, you know, observations and we're having conversations, you're going to put it back in very differently. Mm-hmm. It's kind of that movement that we want to see in progress in therapy is they're starting to recognize some things. And we talk about that awareness being part of that progress, that mm-hmm. even if you're just aware of it, right? Even
I call it the sorting the emotional junk drawer. Like you have all this crap in there and you haven't sorted out and like, why do I have this? I don't need this anymore. Oh, this is useful, but it goes over here. We call Pandora's box. I do the same thing. It's like we all have that stuff. It's not like we're trying to pull up repressed memories. It's not voodoo, but it's paying attention to it and getting it resorted. Yeah. And, you know, and like you said too, you know, there's people like, well, this feels fake to me. I don't know how to do this. And that's where I go back. I like the term gifts of desperation, which comes from 12 step, because it's what you're doing isn't working. Are you desperate enough to try something else? And that desperation, that hitting bottom, is also a gift of like, I am desperate to try something that doesn't feel like me, that doesn't feel normal, that doesn't feel like the way I've always done things. I'm desperate enough and miserable enough to try something that's very weird and uncomfortable because fuck me, nothing else is working.
Yeah, definitely. I think that when we kind of transition into talking about self-compassion, I'm visual, so like any work that I do, I have a worksheet. Like it helps me to help my clients in my mind. So mm-hmm. I always think about and what I talk about is envision helping a child learn how to walk, right? Like this mm-hmm. is you, like you are that baby, right? Because mm-hmm. we also do like reparenting work or inner child work. Mm-hmm. So it's like you are that baby, and you really are learning how to work and make changes. So not work, walk. And so what do you do when the child falls and they mess up or they trip, and how do you respond to that child? And so some of the work that we do is very externalizing, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to envision something external outside of us because we don't have the internal system to be able to visualize that. And so then we have that conversation, a very kind of extensive conversation about how do we respond to children who kind of mess up, and what does it feel like, and how do you support them, and how do you encourage them? And so we talk about the language and the shift in the language, and we talk about comparing it to that inner critic. Mm-hmm. And what would that inner critic say, right? You know, what would that inner critic say, and how would they devalue you and demean you, and would do you want to continue to do that? Mm-hmm. And so now there's a new script that's being built into that person in terms of that compassion, like, okay, can I give myself a break? Like, this is really hard, and we're in the middle of a pandemic, and I do feel sad sometimes, and that's okay, right? Because we are in the middle of a pandemic, and all of us are having to learn how to function in this new way that we're functioning today with work, with our personal relationships, because now we're 24/7 with our partners, for people that are, you know, living with their partners. We're working from home. There's all of these new things we're having to learn. And so can we be compassionate when we are in this position? So it's great work. I love the work.
Yeah. And this kind of gets back to a thing that I know you tell clients all the time, I do too, is I don't know how to do easy work. I don't have magic fixes. Even doing things like hypnotherapy is not a magic fix. It's another tool. Right. And this is like this, like the real work is very difficult and complicated work, and our stuff's always there. Our relationship with it changes. Cause I could be like, so like, when am I done with this? And I'm like, oh shit, I don't know. Like, I'm not done with mine. I still have mine. So if that ever happens, I'll let you know. It looks like it's 37 years.
Yeah.
But I know that my relationship is different with it. I know when my shit comes up, I can go, oh, there it is. Okay, well, I really didn't want to be dealing with this today, but that's what we're doing. And I know it's going to get worse if I don't deal with it. So let me do this now. And, you know, I kind of warn people, like, this isn't going to be fluffy, and this isn't going to be nice, and I'm not going to make you any false promises about eternal sunshine of the spotless mind of your trauma. But I can do hard work if you couldn't do hard work.
Yeah.
And like self-compassion is one of those things that seems really simple. Oh, just be nice to yourself. Just, you know, be your own best friend. Just like, you know, be aware and recognize that everyone struggles, and that's okay. And that's very easy on paper, but it's really difficult in practice. Like most of the most useful things I have found in therapy are. I've had people, like, when I've trained on this particular subject, people are like, yeah, whatever. And then we'll do, like, Kristen Neff does you talked about externalizing, and that's one of the things she does, is just doing this and putting your, you know, hand in your heart. And
right.
Somebody will lose it and start bawling, like, ugly cry, snot down the face, every time I train this and have people do it. Whoever is feeling, like, the most sassy and the most fine with all of this is usually the person that starts crying in the room. It's very... We're not used to doing that for ourselves. No. We're really not. And it's really difficult. It's uncomfortable.
No. To really be able to sit with ourselves in the discomfort of, without allowing the inner critic, that negative voice, to put us in a position where we have to be defensive.
Right? Yeah. And it, you know, noticing it with curiosity, which is a thing I say about mindfulness all the time, like it's not good and bad emotions. Everything is giving you information. So the uncomfortable stuff, be curious about it. And when it's inner critic stuff, the question I always have on my clients is like, so who profits off that emotion? So who wins? Like, do you buy something to fill the void? You know, like, does your shitty abusive father win because you've now internalized that, yes, you're the piece of shit he told you you were? Who profits from you feeling badly about yourself? And, you know, I always get kind of like a, oh, crap. Well, the whole beauty industry does. I'm like, well, and fuck them. And they're like, yeah, you know, so that can be a helpful way of gauging it too. When you're feeling bad, it's like somebody, when you're having a negative emotion, somebody can come out a winner by you feeling bad about yourself, and let's not give them that.
Right. And be very conscious about, you know, and kind of moving back into, because language is really important in therapy. So, I'm very specific when it comes to language. So somebody will say something like, oh, this is one of my pet peeves is, oh, that was ugly. And so it's like, what does that really mean? Like, what's a more accurate word for that? And so helping clients understand that even the things that we don't think anything about, because even, you know, we all kind of say, oh, that was like ugly, you know, meaning that was really mean-spirited, or that was very
unattractive. We should point out that that's very much a South Texas ugly is like, oh, they were acting ugly. Like, you don't hear that in other parts of the country, but we hear ugly.
Right.
And bad behavior. Yeah.
So it's like, well, let's define that a little bit. And then you really kind of get to explore, what value system is this really connected to? And then it's, if that's the value system and kind of like what you're talking about in terms of where is this really coming from and who's benefiting from this, we get to explore that part. And at the end of that long conversation, sometimes what they realize is that they don't have to buy into somebody else's bullshit anymore. And they can have a new sense of, it's okay to be sad about this. And this is really hard work. And it's okay if I take a few minutes to just ponder on whatever they want to ponder on, right? But then it gives them the opportunity to feel it, to be exposed to it, to be curious about it, and then to be able to continue to move forward within their day without it being so overwhelming that they get shut down. And then they're not.
And I say, you know, we'll have a few minutes of crying on the kitchen floor, but eventually we're going to look and go, well, it's really dirty under that cabinet. I should go ahead and clean that. You know, we need our minute in it, but then we move on. I call it the holding the beach ball underwater. When it doesn't feel comfortable to have a feeling, like we keep trying to shove it down. Yeah. We can spend all of our energy doing that. Eventually something else is going to distract us for a minute. It's going to pop up and hit us in the face. So why don't we just deal with the fucking beach ball?
Right. Yeah. I like that analogy.
Yeah.
I think
I do a lot of the same thing of storytelling and, you know, like think of it as a baby walking, and beach ball is one that has resonated with a lot of people, especially for those of us who, you know, were older, grew up in the pool and the beach ball and stuff. So maybe it's a middle aged, but it works. And I have people, they're like, oh man, I was so beach balling my anger this week. Like, and I have people use that and it resonates, and then so they catch it and they're like, I'm beach balling. And so that's one of those things, like we have to find the way of, you know, like connecting it to our own lives. I mean, brains storytell for a reason. That's how we hold information. And so a beach ball underwater is holding that whole complicated process of suppressing emotions in a way that's very like visually accurate for people. We've all done that where we're trying to sit on the beach ball, trying to hold it underwater, trying to float on the beach ball, and boom, gets hit right on top of our face.
Yeah.
And I'm having a bad hair day and I just knocked off my hat. It's my Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma hat. So I just disrespected the Choctaw seal.
So I think that one of the things when I was doing a lot of the research was kind of differentiating between self-care and self-compassion. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting because these days, I think there's a shift now, but I think that there was a really big move in looking at self-care and what that meant and what is the deeper meaning of self-compassion. Mm-hmm. And I really like the idea of self-compassion. When I think about it, I think about self-care as kind of what you do at the end of the day, of a crappy day.
Yeah, that's the action item, I think. And you can't really do the real self-care if you're not self-compassionate. Like, why? Because why would you? Why would you? Or we do dumb shit. We do the, I'm going to go purchase, you know, $300 worth of makeup at the makeup counter, is not coming from a place of self-compassion. That's coming from a place of ugly, right? You know, versus like the really complicated self-care of, I need to make a budget. Or I need to go to the
$300 for makeup. Yeah. And I always talk about, or in my mind, it's self-compassion is about what we're doing during the hard time. Mm-hmm. Right. So as we're crying and upset on the kitchen floor, it's like, I'm going to feel this, and this is really sucky, and this is really hard, and this is a bunch of bullshit, and that's okay that I'm here, because eventually that will pass. And then you will notice, like, the cabinets are really dirty. Now I get to set up, and I've allowed myself this emotional space that we don't allow ourselves when that inner critic is kind of in charge, that we don't allow ourselves to really just be vulnerable in that moment and vulnerable with ourselves, so that we can finally express that and then move forward with.
And when we feel it, we're done with it so much sooner.
Yeah.
You know, and I've talked about that probably in every book. And that's kind of the thing, like, from my Drain book, that people are like, wait, what? When I say, you know, emotions. So this is something that's been talked about in Buddhism for 3,000 years, but we now know from stroke research to be fact, is emotions are information. They're only meant to last about 90 seconds. So if you're feeling really bad and you like, I need to feel this and I need to have my cry on the kitchen floor, if you actually let yourself do that work and you're like, hey, you know, kind of talking to your body, like, hey, little buddy, what's up? Tell me what's going on. And you do that. What's the matter? Do we need to be sad for a minute? Okay, we can be sad. What do I need to be sad about? What's going on? It does what it needs to do. And so then it moves. And it's when we shoving it that it takes over. An emotion is not a mood. A mood is a sustained not dealing with emotional content. It's not the same thing. So when I say you're going to cry on the kitchen floor for a few minutes and then you'll notice something and get ready, like, I'm being very literal. I'll tell people, give yourself 5 minutes to be really upset. And every time I've done that for myself, I'm over it in 3.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to be in this, and okay, we're going to set the timer for 5 minutes. Okay. So go ahead and be worried. You got 5 minutes, be as worried as you want to be. And after 3 minutes, I'm like, oh, well, there's really not much I can do about that. Maybe it's time for lunch. And I'm done and I'm genuinely done with it. It doesn't bubble up and wake me up in the middle of the night because my brain is like, ha, okay, I'm going to make you worry about it now. It's 3 a.m. So it moves out the way it needs to.
No, definitely.
And, you know, and then somatics is part of that too, which is going to be, I think, our next episode is we're going to talk about kind of coaching people through somatic awareness stuff because our interns were interested in that. And so the somatics, which is this whole other topic but relates to this, can be part of that process as well.
Well, it's a part of all of who we are. So I think it is related. I do the same thing though. I'll talk to my clients about using very specific time frames to allow themselves to be fucking crazy. Like, just be upset, be whatever you need to be. And I think that it's the same as that they don't need the whole time. But also challenge them to take 2 minutes to be compassionate with yourself. Yeah. Take a minute to be compassionate with yourself. And be okay with that 1 minute of being compassionate with yourself in a very intentional, like, I'm going to be compassionate, not just allowing myself to feel, but to be very intentional about, like, okay, I'm going to be compassionate with myself for 1 minute. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it can be really challenging, again, for those people who are really challenged with that inner critic that's really, really critical.
And that's where she's talking about the self-kindness in her work. And she also says one of the last stuff that she has is the common humanity.
Yeah.
Which ties to the self-compassion and I think is really important because I tell people, when you're compassionate to other people, but not to yourself, you're saying everyone else is worthy but me, and you've now separated yourself out from all of society. And what is that doing for you? Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things where people look at me and they're like, that's fucked up. You know, and the common humanity part of it is reconnecting us back. Other people experience this. This is part of being human. Being human is very difficult. It's not just difficult to be me, it's difficult to be human. So I can be kind to myself and recognize that this is part of being human, and other people experience this. Mm-hmm. You know, and I teach people like Tonglen breathing. I use a lot of Buddhist-y, they're actually called Buddhist-derived interventions, BDI now, which is interesting to me. So I say not Buddhist in terms of, like, we're going to shave your head and make you wear saffron robes, but Buddha as the first psychologist, you know, so there's a lot of the things that are taught in Buddhism that have a very good mental health effect that really have nothing to do with religiosity. So right. I'll teach people, you know, stuff with that if they're amenable to it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that we do probably a lot of the same work, because we'll talk about also, you know, if you're compassionate with others, and I think there's a shift for me there, is that if you're being compassionate to others, are you really being compassionate, or are you just engaging in the behaviors that you believe are compassionate, and how sustainable is that?
Yeah. Right. And are you letting people off the hook?
Right.
Or right. Are you really going, yeah, that's really hard, but you're still responsible for your
right, behavior. Right. And so we kind of talk about, you know, being compassionate with self as a way to begin to truly be compassionate and empathetic and build the empathy, because we have to build empathy as well as part of that. Mm-hmm. But building empathy into really being able to connect and relate with others, but it not just being, because this is what people always did and I saw it, but I never felt it. And how easy it is to transition from the act of being compassionate to being apathetic, mm-hmm. right? And so we're engaging in behaviors that we think are connected to something, but if we don't feel it, how do we really engage in that, right? And how do we sustain that if we don't have it as really a belief system that's connected to us? And so building that into, for me, like people in recovery, is tough. So these are like long conversations that we have, because it's, I'll tell people, you're literally relearning everything that you ever known about life. Mm-hmm. In a very literal sense, like you're building new neural pathways, you're building new core value systems, you're rebuilding everything in a way that you really want to live a life with intention and integrity. Versus just kind of functioning from, oh, I do this because my mom did it and my dad did this, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, that's, you know, people want recovery. So
yeah, it's a lot of work. And that's, yeah, new places, new spaces, all that stuff. And I tell people too, like, it's okay though. Like, we didn't teach these things in kindergarten. So I wouldn't have a job if people knew how to communicate with I statements and take responsibility for their emotions and stuff that you're like, well, this seems really simple. And I'm also really hard because nobody has ever taught it. You and I would not have jobs if these were sort of these foundations of society things. Right. And so we're having to kind of go against all that and say, no, I'm going to choose differently. Yeah. This is kind of fucked up and maybe I don't have to do it that way. And that's really difficult, complicated work. And so people are like, well, why is it so hard for me? Because it's hard. It's hard work.
Hard for everybody, not just you.
Yeah. Yeah, for everybody. And I mean, all of society is sort of conspired against you. They would rather you be mindless so they can get you to eat a bag of Oreos that they sold you. And they would, you know, they would rather you be mindless so you feel bad about yourself and don't stand up to your boss and say, no, I need to be making more money than I'm making. I mean, you know, all of those things, you know, the mindlessness of saying, hey, I don't think that this is, I don't think we should probably, like, you know, be poisoning the air and the water. Like, there are very good reasons for society to want us to be mindless. We're easier to control.
That social conditioning, rape culture, like all of these systems mm-hmm. out there that are kind of putting us in a position to buy into the bullshit, like mm-hmm. kind of okay, like don't, it's not a big deal.
It is, but it's fine. And I always say too, like for people, you know, especially for people that are you know, they pride themselves on being tough and being survivors, which you should pride yourself on. Like, so why would I do this work? I don't want to be a pussy ass bitch. And I'm like, this is political. Like, you're making a choice to say the system's broken and I'm not going to buy this bullshit anymore. Like, I'm going to live intentionally and different and care about myself and care about other people. Like, that's hardcore. You know, that is like, that is a political statement. You know, you're living in a world that would be just fine if you killed yourself. And if you're like, no, fuck you, I deserve to live too. you're making that, to me, that's badass. And so that can be a really useful way of framing it when it feels like this is woo-woo work.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, I suspect that we both get really tough clients, but I've gotten some really tough clients that would very much say that, like, I don't want to be, like, weak. Like, they look at being conscious as weakness, and they begin to learn how actually difficult it is, mm-hmm. right? To be very conscious, to be intentional, to recognize that what I want is far off from who I'm being today. So we talk a lot about peace, not so much happiness, but about finding peace in decisions, mm-hmm. And being compassionate with yourself, versus trying to find happiness with, you know, getting plastic surgery or all of these other things that we can kind of find happiness in temporarily, but really looking at peace and what is the real end goal of therapy and how do we really get there. And the self-compassion is just one of those components. Like, I honestly haven't done it very long. It's maybe been, I think, a couple of years.
I mean, the research on it in general is only about a decade old. This is not, it's one of those things that we're starting to see as a buzzword. But the idea of it, you know, having it have like clinical impact and wellness impact beyond, like, for people that are, you know, practicing Buddhism is new. So for people who are like, I've kind of heard this, but what are you talking about? Well, there's a reason. You know, that it hasn't been around long. And I honestly don't even know how I bumped into her book, because I found it pretty quickly after it came out, probably because I was already a practicing Buddhist at that time. So that's probably how I bumped into it. But, you know, I was bringing it in, and I worked at a place where we took turns facilitating, like, hey, this is what I'm excited about, so I want to share it with everybody. And everyone's like, what is this? Now people are starting to, like, know what I'm talking about a little bit, but when it first came out, people had no idea. When I'm like, hey, I would like to, you know, knocking on people's doors, handing them pamphlets on self-compassion. So it's not, and so there's a lot of research now. They've done a lot in a decade, but this is not like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy that's been around for 50 years.
It's a fairly new thing. I think it's really interesting. I think it's great for deep work, and is within itself just a component that you can spend some time on, like, not just one session of, like, okay, just envision yourself as a little kid and every time you fall, like, no, like, it's connected to so many things that, as complicated as we are, that who we are, that it's one of those components that's a little bit deeper, longer term in terms of therapy that we kind of address and look at. So.
And outside of therapy, it's sort of that continuous work, because I'll tell people, like, you may not have, like, a big insight in my office, but you're going to be driving home a week from now and you're going to go, fuck me, you know, and the pieces will start. And so you'll do that. And I do it all the time. So, like, this is, you know, we're planting seeds and we're sorting the junk drawer a little bit. And then a couple weeks from now, you're going to go, oh, that's why I do that. Yeah, you know, people expect, like, you're going to have these big aha moments in therapy, and therapy is the groundwork. The aha moments sometimes happen in therapy, but more often happen when you're driving.
Out in the community, yeah. I love hearing when my clients have those aha moments in the community. I get so excited for them because it is moving them. Mm-hmm. And they get to become much more conscious and live with so much more intent than what they would have been before. So I absolutely love hearing about those. I get really excited for people. And my hardcore guys are like, I don't like you being excited for me. Well, I'm excited for you anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So being excited.
I tell people, like, I'm going to believe in you enough for both of us until you're ready to believe in yourself. I got this. And we're like, yeah. I'm doing it. You can't stop me. Yeah. And everybody needs the auntie who loves them like that. So even though they kind of get a little grumpy, they don't mind.
The cheerleader of, like, yeah. For you. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you know, that's work too though, right? Because then they don't take compliments very well. And so then that's another kind of different topic. But you know, it helps them to understand that this work is tough. Mm-hmm. Love is so hard. It's,
Yeah. Well, and I also tell people too, I'm like, am I nice? And they're like, oh, actually, I guess you're not pretty. You're not nice. Like, you push me, we work hard. Like, you're not mean, but you're not, oh, well, that's okay. Yeah. I said, so if I give you a compliment, am I lying? You know, and they're like, oh, yeah, no, you call me out pretty regularly. So if you're telling me I'm doing something well, I probably actually am. I'm like, and there we go.
So I know
that's the argument that I have about it. I'm like, I don't give bullshit compliments. So if I told you, you nailed it, you nailed it. Like, you can trust me. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, but it's definitely true. I think we do really hard work and we hold people accountable. Mm-hmm. And thankfully we can do it in a way that people are receptive. Yeah. Because they
keep, you know, not
surprising, you're back. Like, but I was so hard on you last time. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and it's fun. And I'm just like, and you know, and I say, I understand where this is coming from. There are all the reasons why you're doing it, but now it's time to stop. You know, and if you want therapy as rent a friend, you can find a therapist that'll do that. I don't, and that like, that's okay. That's cool. Like, if you want to lay on somebody's couch and be like, my mom was so mean, and the therapist is like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You can find somebody who does that. I only know how to do hard work. So, you know, and clients will be like, I'll call something out, and they're like, oh, you bitch. And I'm like, I know. And they're like, fuck, you know, like, so we have a sense of humor.
Yeah, I've definitely been
called. They're like, ow, all right, shit. But yeah, I mean, the people that see us are the people that are like wanting to do the work, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So fun stuff. What do you think?
That is self-compassion in a nutshell, and we can get angry emails about the parts that we got wrong. So yeah, I think next time our plan was, I had my interns were asking about how so much early childhood trauma is coming up in the pandemic because it's reinforcing our sense of powerlessness. And then how do we work with that somatically, like in this distance sense? And I know my learning curve with that has been really steep. So they had asked for like some supervision time on that. So I decided, they don't know this yet, we're going to record it on Zoom so other people can kind of share some of the stuff that we're doing to help people. You know, and the short part of that is therapy, like 90% of therapy is being able to co-regulate off of your therapist's calm nervous system. They come into our room and they're able to regulate because we can hold space for them to do that. And they can't. And that's a very literal electrical energy thing that happens by being in the same room. And we don't have that right now. So how do you teach somebody that and guide somebody through that by fucking phone when they're not able to bounce off of you and do it? And so that'll be podcast number three. Mm-hmm. Ooh, good nails, girl. That's a good.
It's the attunement, you know, being able for them to look at us and we attune to them. But the co-regulation is that we're in charge, right?
Yeah.
Is that we're in control, we're in charge, and they're looking at us and being attuned to us too, as a support system, but also as kind of the experts.
Right. And it's no different than, you know, even just like, you know, if a toddler falls and hurts themselves learning to walk, you pick them up and you soothe them. And therapy is very much a doing that, even when we're holding someone accountable and stuff. they're regulating off of our, like, oh, it's okay, like, we got this, we can do this. And that's so much harder to do somatically distance. And, you know, so video crashes, and so we're doing a phone call, and I'm like, I can only go on your voice, your tone just changed, what's up? You know, and then having to teach people those somatic tools has been interesting in steep learning curve. So we'll do that next. It'll be good stuff for a therapist, but also just good stuff for people who are trying to, you know, even do their own regulation. It's a cheaper than therapy because it's free on YouTube. Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you.
We're doing that like in a couple weeks. So we'll have a new episode up, I think, like in, I don't know, 3 weeks or something. Yeah.
Okay. All righty. Thank you,
everybody.
Bye.
Bye.